Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the exploration of the human race, of who we are, of what's really going on planet Earth, and who we are in relationship to the cosmos. And not only that, are we alone? Are there visitors? Well, it's not even a question if you've been listening to this program, because so many people, researchers, experiences have had contact with beings that are obviously from other realms, other dimensions. And what is the spiritual element of these connections is everything I want to talk to tonight's guest about. Dr. Artie Sixkiller-Clark. And she's a professor emeritus at Montana State University, and she's dedicated her life to working with indigenous populations. And her bestseller book was called Sisters in Blood, but her new book, just coming out, is called Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians. Well, I guess it's been out for a while. And then, oh, this one, second book, UFO, Sky People, Untold Story of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. That's the book that's just come out. Sorry, Artie. Thanks thanks for being here. Oh, so this is your second book on the Star People
correct.
Tradition. Okay, well, let's talk about that because, you know, John Mack, Dr. John Mack from Harvard University, who really got into these stories of connections and abductions and interactions, said that the point of view of the Western mind that we're alone in the universe is a minority, that for the majority of people, they know we're part of a greater cosmos. So talk about what your experience is and what you found in your research.
Well, I agree with Dr. Mack. Mm-hmm. I have spent the last 30-some years researching and talking with indigenous people worldwide, and there's no doubt in my mind that we're not alone. I began my research when I first came to Montana many years ago as a new assistant professor. And at that time, I was not only an assistant professor, but I was the director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education in the College of Education. And one of my roles was to go out to the reservations in Montana and the neighboring states and to recruit young people to enter the profession of teaching or becoming superintendents and principals in on reservation schools. Because at that time, there were very, very few Native people who were working in the field of education. And so I would go out, and I had a scholarship package I could offer them and support if they wanted to get degrees in teacher education. And on my very first trip to a reservation in Montana, I was introduced to a young man who took care of me and who arranged everything for me to meet the students. And after the meetings with the students were over, he asked me, he said, "Would you like to go to dinner?" And so we went out and we had dinner. And then on the way back, he said to me, he said, "You know, if you have a few minutes, I'd like to show you something." So I said, "Sure." And so he took me up in the mountains above his village, and he parked the car, leaned over, and got a pair of binoculars and said, if we're lucky, they'll come. And I said, "Who?" And he said, "Well, the ancestors, the star people." And so I just followed him blindly to this boulder, and we sat down and waited. Well, unfortunately, nothing happened. But as we waited, he told me the story about how the ancestors came back frequently and hovered over his village, and that they often came back and met with the elders of his tribe. Well, on my way back to the university, I kept thinking about this because I had heard stories of the star people when I was growing up. And the thought occurred to me that if his story and my story there must be more stories out there that I could see what the connection was among indigenous people, and Native Americans particularly. And so when I would go to conferences and have go out to dinner or, you know, just hanging out with people, or when I would go on site to recruit students, and later when I was doing research on reservations, I would, you know, frequently find myself in casual situations where I could talk to people about UFOs and star people and things of that nature. And during that course of time, I collected hundreds of stories, and I had just kept them for my own personal enjoyment. I had never used them in any way. And a couple of years after I came out of retired, I was offered by the, you know, to do a federal government evaluation of a tribal grant that had been issued to a tribe. And I went back to Washington, D.C., and I took the training, learned what they expected to be included in their evaluations. And then I went on to the reservation, and I met with the key players, with tribal people. Mm-hmm. And when lunchtime came, I met with a group of women. We were having lunch together. And for some reason, the topic of UFOs came up. And I to this day, can't remember how it came up. But I started to tell them a couple of stories that I had collected over the years. Mm-hmm. And this one elderly woman looked at me, and she said to me, she said, "What are you going to do with those stories when you die?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you know, I suppose whoever gets my stuff will just probably toss them away." Mm-hmm. She looked at me very seriously, and she said, "You know, you have a responsibility. This is our oral history. These are our stories, and you have a responsibility to share them."
Yeah.
And so I came back. As I was driving back, I thought, now I can't do both of these. I can't make a 5-year commitment to do this federal evaluation and write a book at the same time. So I decided the next day, I called up and I said, "You know, I'm going to bow out of this evaluation, and I'm going to write the book." And that's what I did. Encounters with Star People was the result 12 months later.
So I'm glad you decided to write it too, because it's important. So is it much more common among Native Indigenous people, this interaction, or is it sort of the same ratio to the rest of the population?
You know, I don't know, because as I was visiting reservations and collecting stories, you know, there are a lot of non-Native people who work on reservations and who live on reservations. And it was surprising to me how many of them approached me and told me stories. Mm. And you know, they weren't as frequent of as the Native stories, but then I didn't set out to collect non-Native stories. So I can't really answer that question, but I have some wonderful stories from non-Native.
I want to hear those great stories. But before we go into the stories, I'm just curious if you could, was there a general sort of consensus among all these stories of what you put together with patterns of who these beings are and where they came from? Is it, or are they all so different?
Well, it's clear to me that there are different species visiting our planet, and some of them are quite they're peaceful. They don't interfere with our lives. They I've been told that one of the reasons why they do not communicate with humans is simply because we aren't advanced enough for them, you know, to communicate with humans. But on the other hand, there are species out there who are, you know, just as violent as humans are. And so they can take whatever they want to take and do whatever they want to do. And those are the groups that I'm generally hear are the ones who are abducting people.
Oh. So some of them look human and some of them look gray or alien.
Yes.
Is that... Oh, right.
And
well,
I've even run on to stories of some of them, you know, a couple of times of giants. And I have run on to stories that's of the like the tall whites, but also people who look just like humans that are not of the tall white group. So, I've collected a few stories of people who say that they have scaly skin like lizards.
Oh, I've heard that. Yes.
And so you know, it's obviously there are a variety of alien entities out there observing Earth, making contact with Earth, and who have different agendas.
So some of these stories are actual eyewitness stories, and the other stories are traditions that have been passed down. Is that it?
All of the stories are eyewitness stories that are in my book. In many cases, I might tell of, you know, you know, other stories that in the research that are at least similar in some way, or tell of an ancient story. Particularly when I was in Belize and Guatemala and Honduras and Mexico, I would hear about ancient legends about a village. Of a star man that came on a beam of light and stayed in the village. And I was really interested in those kind of things, and I would go investigate and find the ancient story, have the elders, you know, retell the ancient stories to me, and then search for people who may have had recent encounters. And so I might use that as a preface to a story. But it had nothing to do with the ancient legend. Basically, I was in the community where the ancient event occurred. And it had been told and retold and retold by the people.
So you preface that stories with some of the ancient stories.
Right.
And but maybe you'll get to it in some of the stories, but the spirituality of the Native Americans fit into these sky people?
Well, I think that indigenous people, you know, vary in their belief about spirituality and the sky gods. It's much more prevalent among the Maya in Central America and Mexico than it is among Native Americans. Native Americans don't seem to see it so much as a spiritual connection as it is an encounter with the ancients or the ancestors, you know, who have gone, you know, who have either spent time on Earth and have gone back to the stars, and not so much that they look to them as gods, you know, in among the Maya, you know, it's difficult to differentiate between when you're talking to some of the people about the sky people and the sky gods and the star men, they all seem to kind of blend together.
Uh-huh.
And then you get these stories that say, well, you know, we are those people. We are the same. We are their children. They came here, and they stayed. And so it's a combination of many different things, but not so much religion is attached
to it. Yeah, what did you end up like sort of believing or feeling from all these stories? How did it affect your belief system?
Well, you know, it didn't change it at all, because when I set out I expected to find these stories because, as I said, you know, I'd heard stories of star people when I was a child. And so I wasn't surprised by the stories that I collected. Sometimes I was surprised by the events, but not because they were, I felt that the people were lying to me, but because they were so unique and so different and so honest in their narration of what occurred to them.
Wow. Well, I'm excited. Well, tell me one of your favorite stories, or what you really, you know, really juicy one. I'm interested.
Well, I'll tell you. I'll start out first with, since you mentioned Encounters with Star People.
Yeah.
And that was my first book that was published back in 2012. I had been at the University of a few years, and I was going to the reservation, and I had a colleague approach me and ask me if I would be willing to stop off at this drum maker's place and pick up a drum that he had ordered. And this man was fairly well known, I guess, in native circles for his drum making, and he had paid the man, and he had promised to make this drum for him. And he said, you know, since you're going that way, do you think you could pick it up for me? And I said, sure. So when I finished my work there, and I could have come back on Friday night, but I decided, no, I'm going to stay. I'm going to find this elder, and I'm going to get that drum and just take my time going back home. So when I arrived at his place, he welcomed me into his home, and he offered me fresh coffee that he was brewing. And as we talked about his life and what he had done, and he was had been a veteran of World War I, I believe, and when he came home, he talked about how he never left. And he lived in a very isolated section, in a cabin way out in the middle of nowhere. And he said, well, you know, there's some advantages and disadvantages to living here. He said, I've never missed the company of people. He said, you know, I like my animals, and I don't have much need for anything, but I have a couple close friends. But he said, there are strange things that happen here. And I said, well, what kind of strange things? And he says, come with me. And he took me over to the kitchen window, and he pointed out the window, and he says, can you see from here those tracks that go through that field? And I said, yes. And he said, well, what do they look like to you? And I said, well, they look like car tracks. And he said, exactly. But I don't own a car. I've never owned a car. And he said, no one comes here and drives through my fields that I know who owns a car. And so then he took me outside, and he walked me down those car tracks. And we came to this huge dead circle in the middle of his field. And he said, these UFOs, they come here, and they hover over my land. And they drop down on an automobile, and it's filled with people. They drive through my fields. They go to the highway. The next morning, the car comes back, but there are no people in it. And he says, I think aliens are being planted all over the United States. And I said, well, why do you think that? And he said, they don't stay here. Whoever those people are, they don't stay here, because everybody would know there were strangers on the reservation. Yeah. He said, so they don't stay here. They're taking them someplace, maybe to a bus terminal or maybe to an airport. But they don't stay here, he says. And he says, it really concerns me. And so, you know, as time passed and I would go back and visit him, he would tell me about things that occurred. And One time he told me that the UFO came and hovered over his property, and the car was lifted down, but the car got stuck and had a flat tire. And he said the driver came to his door and stood there, didn't knock on the door, didn't make any effort to alert him that he needed help. And he said, I saw him there, and I waited. And he said, finally, I opened the door, and he simply walked toward the car. When I got there, he said, I realized it had a flat tire. And I explained to him that I had to change the tire, and the people inside the car would have to get out. And he said, they got out on the far side away from me. And he said, they behaved very strangely. They huddled all together away from me. And I changed the tire, and he said, when I finished, he said, the man gave me 10 silver dollars. And I said, well, do you still have those silver dollars? And he reached in his pocket, and he put one on the center of the table, and he says, this is the only one that's left. He said, I sold the others. The man told me that I sold them to, if I ever got any more, he'd buy those, but he says, I've never had a chance to get any more.
What year was that silver dollar? I guess was it a current one, or was it an old silver dollar?
It was an old silver dollar, and I own it today. He left it to me when he passed away, and it was 1923.
Wow, that's an amazing story. So those were alien beings or maybe they were hybrid human aliens that were being dropped off all over the U.S.
Right. Well, he was very concerned about it. He thought although, you know, when I was in Mexico, I met an elder who told me that beings from the stars were quite capable of assuming any form that they wanted to, that they could be standing next to you and you wouldn't know because they had the ability to assume the identity of any living organism that was on the planet that they visited. But so that they could meld right into society and no one would ever really know.
But that is so strange that he changed the tires, the flat tire. That is, and you know, of course, he wasn't. Who would make something like that up?
That's right. I mean, it wasn't a story that was made up.
Right, but that's a great story. Thank you.
I mean, there's just so many stories like that. Of, you know, I knew this elder named Harrison, and for many years I had known him, and we were not. You know, he was very suspicious of me when he first met me, because I was a university professor, and his district had requested that his school district, I mean, he was a cultural specialist for the tribe, but the school district where he lived had requested that I come to their reservation and help them write a bilingual education grant, because many of their students were native speakers. And they wanted to get bilingual funds to help these native students transition into speaking English so that they would be successful in school. And when I went there, he told me, in no uncertain terms, that he didn't understand why they had to invite me to come there help them write a grant when I didn't know anything about their tribe. And so for quite a while, you know, we had this kind of a relationship. He respected me and I respected him, but we had this gap between us. As years went on, we became friends. And it took quite some time before he got to the point where he realized that I was okay, and I got to the point where I realized he wasn't going to throw me off the reservation. Mm-hmm. And so I met him this one, as I said, I'd known him for years, and he asked me, he said, that would you like he said, you believe in the star people, don't you? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, I have something I want to show you, but he said, I have something I want to tell you, but in order to tell you, I have to show you. Mm-hmm. And so he said, tomorrow morning I'll pick you up, and I'll take you to my home place, because that's where the event occurred. Mm-hmm. So he picked me up at the motel the next day, and we drove about 60, 70 miles out into the country. And when we finally turned off this dirt road, we were literally following a cow trail. There was no driveway to his grandfather's place. It was just going through the fields. Right. And it was about a 3-mile, 4-mile ride to his grandfather's place. And he had inherited this place after his grandfather had died. And he spent some time there in the summers, but most of the time the place was boarded up and closed up. And he began to tell me the story about when he was a boy, his parents both worked for the tribe. So when school was out in May, they would pack up a paper bag with his extra set of clothes and some books and take him out and drop him off at his grandpa's house. And he would stay there for the whole summer. And then they would come back to him a week, come and get him the week before school started. And this was the routine of his life all the way through high school. Mm-hmm. And he said that on this one particular time that he went to his grandfather's house, his grandfather was very upset because the Corps of Engineers, his grandfather had this major river that flowed through his property, and the Corps of Engineers had come in there and they were going to build a dam. And a major concern to his grandfather was that then non-native people would be coming on his land and fishing and doing all sorts of things. And so he didn't like that. But he didn't like the fact that they told him that as he was, that he would have to move away. Hmm. And the reason he was so concerned was that a few years before, a UFO had crashed on his grandfather's property.
Oh.
And it had crashed. It had embedded itself into a butte that was right above the river. And he said that you couldn't really see it because it kind of camouflaged itself into the butte. Mm. And he said that there were aliens on board who survived and that they lived there on his grandfather's place and his grandfather protected them.
Oh.
And that they lived there for some time until a rescue craft came and picked them up. And he told me the story. He said that his grandfather said, you know, they dressed in these clothes that when they walked into the water, they came out and the clothes were dry, and his grandfather wished he could have some clothes like that. That his grandfather one time went hunting and took some food, and they explained that they didn't eat food. He, as a young boy, went into the craft.
Wow.
And he said that there were chairs there, and when he sat down in one of the chairs, it embraced him and folded around him, and it frightened him so that he thought he started to struggle, and he wasn't going to be able to get out. And how, you know, he calmed himself down and thought, I want to get out of this chair. And the chair opened. So he felt that the spacecraft itself was almost like a living entity, and that if he thought something, the spacecraft could respond to him. But he had no means of explaining why. How he thought this was possible.
Other people have said that about their spacecraft. It's like a living being. So that is, does confirm what other people have thought as well. So,
this is from a little boy's perspective. You know, I mean, these are the thoughts that he had, you know, about what was going on.
But he took you out to the land, and what did you see out there?
Well, of course, by that time, he showed me where it originally had been, but by that time, the Corps of Engineers had come through there and had built that dam and had excavated the property till you could no longer even see it. And the water was above the level where the spacecraft would have been. But he said that his grandfather felt that they had found the spacecraft and had removed it.
Oh.
And I said, well, why wouldn't someone on the reservation notice? He said, all they would have had to do is throw a tarp over it. Because he said, you know, at that time, cars, you know, were not the norm, you know, for the reservation. And to see all this big equipment, people would literally stand along the side of the roads and watch all this big equipment come in when they were building the dam. And he said they would wave to the drivers. They just, it was like a show for them. And he said that the military could have removed that spacecraft. And no one would have ever known about it.
How'd they know it was there, or they just came upon it because
they were excavating, I'm sure.
Did they know it was there? Did they track it, or they just found it?
Well, I don't know, and he didn't know. It was his grandfather's suspicion that the spacecraft was no longer there, that they had found it.
Did his grandfather take any pictures? I guess they don't really, of these beings?
Well,
this was
pre-Roswell.
Any artifacts remained?
No. Well, he wanted to take something. He told me that he found these containers of this stuff that was really gooey and slimy, and wanted to take one, and his grandfather told him no. He said that it was sacred and that he could not take anything. And so he left it there.
Did he see the aliens too, the guy who took you out there?
He did not. Only his grandfather. And his grandfather described them to him, and, you know, that they were human-like. One of the things he said that he wasn't sure if some died, because there were 19 chairs on the craft and only 17 aliens that his grandfather counted.
Oh.
So they weren't sure what happened there. But while they were staying there, they went about collecting all sorts of biological and botanical things, you know, and storing them. And his grandfather was sure they were taking them back with them to wherever they came.
Did they speak to him telepathically or in English or whatever language?
Well, you know, his grandfather didn't speak English, so, you know, I'm sure that they were, you know, his grandfather communicated with him, so they must have been able to communicate with him in some fashion that wasn't in speaking English.
Maybe it was telepathy. So was that in Montana that happened, or where was the location generally?
Well, the general area of the Dakotas.
Oh, that's an amazing. Thank you for anything else like that. I mean, you've collected hundreds of stories, huh?
Yes, one man talked to me about people who disappeared and didn't come back, and he told me about this family that lived near him that came up missing, and that they, the whole family was missing. Now, this family didn't have any means of transportation except horses, and they would frequently ride their horses up to the road and wait and try to hitch rides with a school bus or anything that was going by. And he said that there was a that when they came up missing and people went to their places, that food was still on the stove and on their plates. It was like they were getting ready to sit down to eat, and yet there was no sign of them. And when, you know, everyone was alerted and was looking for them, the elders would just say, you know, they've gone to live in the stars. And he said he had heard that comment many times as, you know, growing up. And so he said that he lived not too far from where this family lived.
Where was that exactly? What state are we talking?
Well, this is still in the Dakotas.
Okay.
And it's in the same, in a very close by area. And he said that the house remained abandoned for quite some time. And then when the Corps of Engineers built the dam, the house was submerged in water, that the water covered their house. And he said just a few months later, after the dam was built, he was down on the edge of the lake and had taken his horses down there to drink. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how all of a sudden the horses became very alert and started heading back toward the house. And he looked up and he saw this UFO. And he said he wasn't sure what he should do because he had been in the military and he had seen... He said the UFO was as big as a battleship. That's what he told me. And he said, and I was in the military, and I know what a battleship looks like, and I know how big they are. And this craft was as big as a battleship. So he said he tried to decide what to do. Should he take the route of the horses and follow them back to his house, or should he try to hide? So he said he decided to run back to his house. And when he got there, he said there were two beings in his house. Now, it's dark by now, and they are searching. And he talks about them having this long-like stick, and they are searching for something. And he tries to tell them. They tell him that they will not hurt him, and they will leave soon. Mm-hmm. And he says he tries to tell them, tell me what you're looking for, and I will help you. And they don't respond to him. And he becomes very frustrated, and he stands, he said, with his back up against the wall near the doorway, thinking of how he's going to get out of the house the quickest. And they leave. They just leave. And he said he followed them outside. He gets his gun. He follows them outside, and they go to the site where this family once lived.
Oh.
Now, he believes that they had mistaken his house for theirs, because from the time this family had been there, had disappeared, now their house was underwater.
Oh.
And they had mistaken his house for the house of this family. And he thought something was left behind there that they wanted.
What year was that family disappeared?
It was in the 40s, and I don't quite recall. Oh, it's in the book. But, you know, I'm trying to write down so many stories that you have to check the book.
So what? How far back?
It was pre-Roswell.
So when you went and you covered the Native Americans, and then you decided to go down to Mexico, right?
Listen
to... What was the difference in these Mesoamericans?
Well, I think I should maybe speak a little bit to why I went there.
Yeah, you did say that there was they focused more on generalities. Would you say hello?
Well, I think not generalities, but their stories were somewhat different. Back when I was in high school, and I had a teacher come to me one day, and she said, you know, I think you'd really enjoy this book. She said, it's about the Maya Indians. And she handed me a book called Incidents of Travel in Central America, the Chiapas and the Yucatan. And it was a 19th century account of these two explorers, Frederick Catherwood and John L. Stevens. Stevens was an American, and Catherwood was an Englishman, who was a trained architect and quite talented artist and had an inordinate amount of ability in drawing ancient structures, and had gone through the Middle East and had done this, had recorded the ancient treasures of that part of the world. And so they decided that they had heard rumors of these ancient cities that were in the jungles. And so they set off to see if these stories were true. Well, I read the book, and I was just fascinated. And I went back to the teacher after I'd read the book, and I said, you know, one of these days, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to follow in their footsteps. And she said, well, before you do that, she said, there's another book they wrote about the second trip they took. And it's called The Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan. And this book concentrated on their second trip to that part of the world where they only went to the land today that's known as Mexico. And so I had promised myself that one day I was going to do this. And so I began my journey in 2004, following in their footsteps. I first went to the country of Belize because they had originally landed in 1839 in Belize City, in what was at that time called British Honduras.
Okay.
And actually, they only stayed in Belize a couple of days and used it to just rest from their sea voyage. And then they went into Guatemala. And all the time that they were in that part of the world, there was a civil war going on, and the British and the Spanish were fighting over the country. And then there were a lot of indigenous uprisings going on because they wanted to get rid of both the British and the Spanish. And so there were a number of things, and it was quite a dangerous journey and a tedious journey. And I had such admiration for them because I just couldn't imagine what it would be like to go on donkeys and on horseback. And at one time, you know, Stevens was so ill that he had to be carried up the mountains by Indians. And so, but they were just determined to bring this knowledge to the world. In fact, Stevens is called the father of American archaeology.
So you go on this trip following them. Yes,
and going to all the places that they had visited, as well as, you know, of course, you know, as I, you know, this was many years after I had promised myself I would go. I had read Eric von Daniken's theories about how the Maya, you know, had built these cities under the direction of ancient astronauts, you know, who had all the knowledge, and that the Maya were simply peons who, you know, participated in the project. And then when the aliens went home, you know, the Maya didn't know what to do with them. So, you know, basically thinking the Maya, you know, as an ethnocentric view of the native people. And so I decided, well, along the way, because I've been collecting stories all these years, I'm going to see if I can locate and find out about any native any indigenous connection with UFOs and sky gods and star people. And so I was able to locate and employ drivers and guides and interpreters who shared my interest in that area and who provided me access and who introduced me to people and who protected me and watched out for me and took me throughout this region. And during that time, I was just amazed at some of the stories that that.
Well, like, what did you hear there? What did you, like?
Just... Well, I learned about the people of the Shining Hand, who were, we were in Guatemala and had pulled off the highway. We had visited my driver's sister and had spent the night at her house and had attended the festivities. There was some kind of a celebration for the saints. And we had decided to stay overnight at his sister's house. And she was a school teacher. And she was the English teacher in this high school near Guatemala City. And so my driver said to me as we were leaving, he said, shall we take a roundabout way and I can show you some other sites that aren't well known and some that haven't even been excavated. And so I said, that's a great idea. We, you know, spend the day doing that. And his sister had packed us a lunch. And so about noon, we pulled off the highway and we were under the shade of a ceiba tree. We were just getting ready to have lunch when this elderly man appeared. He spoke to my driver in his native dialect and explained to him that he was a caretaker of this ancient site, and we didn't even know we were at an ancient site. And when he discovered I was an American, from then on he used English. He told me that he was once illegally in the United States, but he just saved enough money to build a home for his mother and went back because he didn't like it here, because he was always afraid he was going to get caught, and it made him too nervous. So he had built it, and then he said that at one time the government had come to this place and had built a hut for a caretaker. And that the caretaker was supposed to look after this place once that it had when the archaeologists came in, so that people wouldn't steal the artifacts and everything. And so he said, but then they didn't come. And so he said, when they didn't come and they abandoned the whole thing, I just moved into the place and decided to take care of it anyway. And so we invited him to share our lunch with him, and he took us to his little place. And there on a shelf, he had various English language novels. I saw Stephen King and Danielle Steele and a few of those things. And then I gave him some of the books I had been carrying around and had read. And he said, you know, in return for our gifts, that he wanted to show me the site. And I followed along behind him, choosing my steps really carefully, because there were remains of temples everywhere and rocks that were just stones that from temples and structures. And he led me to a wooden bench in front of a stone edifice. And it was the only standing structure. It was only the front of the structure. And where everything else was a mound of rubble, here was this structure in the middle of this site. And the structure had a smooth arch over the doorway. And there were painted red hands decorating the facade of this structure. And he goes on to explain to me that he built this bench so that he could come there every morning and sit. And he said, this is the altar of the Shining Ones. And I said, well, who are the Shining Ones? And he said, well, they're the space people. He said, the sky gods or the star people, whatever you want to call them, he says. But they're the ones who left their handprints. And I said, what do you know about the star people? And he says, well, I know there are many different kinds of star people, but they come from different places. But he says there's only one group that's really connected to the Maya. And he said some of the star people are from our solar system, but not most of them. And then he goes on to tell me that the Shining people have told him there are 67 solar systems in a confederation, and that on any given day there might be as many as 1,000 spacecraft that can view, that can see Earth from the sky. And he said, our governments don't have the technology to see these spacecraft. And he said, and many of the people from space are living on Earth, he said, and watching and helping humans. And he goes on to tell me that they have specific tasks, and he said they don't live here permanently. He said when they come, they are come to help certain people, like scientists or doctors, or, and he said they never reveal who they are to their human friends. And he said right now they're gone. They're not here. He said they come in 16-year cycles. But pretty soon they'll come again. He said they left in 2000, and they'll be back in 2016. He said they stay away for 16 years. And then they leave for 16 years, and he said then they'll come back again. And I said, well, what do they look like? And he said, well, like you and me. But he said they can look like anyone they want to look like. On this planet, he said they look human, but on another planet, they're going to look like the dominant species. He said, but in their true state, that they were balls of light. And it is only when they assume human form, he said, that you see them. Otherwise, you are blinded by them and just think it's some kind of a visual illusion. And I said, well, what can you tell me about the red hands? And he said, well, he said, I'm sure you've seen them in other places if you've visited indigenous sites. He says, in Mexico, in Guatemala and Honduras, they're quite prevalent. And he says, there are stories about the Brothers of the Red Hand. And he said, they were a part of the Shining people, but they were a group of sky men who traveled throughout the universe collecting knowledge. And he said, they held all the secrets of the origins of all the people on Earth and on every populated planet. And when they passed by, they left their handprints on the places they passed. And he said that, so if you see the red hands, you know that the Shining people, the Brothers of the Red Hand and the Shining people have passed there. And they've been on Earth since the beginning of time. And he said that some people have interpreted the handprints as being the signature of a builder of a certain structure, but he says that's not true. These were the knowledge keepers. And so I found this story very fascinating.
Oh, Artie.
Yeah.
Sorry, I lost you again. I don't know why it keeps going in and out. But you were saying, though, that these people can't be seen. Can you repeat that part about that just for me? You know, where you were saying that...
That in their natural form, they appear as balls of light. And so people look at them and consider them and maybe an illusion or, you know, some kind of a freak of nature. But he says, you know, that's their true form. But they can assume the identity of humans or any dominant species on any planet that they visit.
Now, did you ever have any personal experience? Did you ever see anything or interact?
I've had a number of personal experiences, but I don't want to talk about that at this point because all I can tell you is I believe. I not only believe, I know they exist. So.
So what do we do with all this? Is there a chance that, I mean, I'm interested in reading your whole book and because it's great to hear you tell the stories, but there's so much more that, you know, you can't say in the short time. But what do we do with all this information? How do we get it into the awareness of a bigger, you know, population?
Well, I think just the knowledge that that we're not alone, and that there are other intelligent life forms in the universe. I think it gives, you know, I talked to one man who told me, he said, they give me hope. They make me believe.
Do you think the difference?
They make me believe there's something bigger than what I am. And I think that's what it's all about, is an understanding that we aren't alone.
Yeah, we're part of something bigger. There's a much bigger thing.
Well, I have a sore throat and I'm having difficulty talking.
You told us a lot of beautiful things, so I want to thank you for that. Though.
Well, I sure appreciate it, and you know, I my books are available at Amazon.com, mm-hmm. and you can go to my website, www.sixkiller.com, and I have a lot more information there. I have a schedule of future interviews and where I'm going to be speaking and book signing and everything there. And I encourage anyone who reads my books to feel free to write to me at artie6killer@sixkiller.com.
Yes.
I don't have a staff, so I answer all my own emails. Might take me a day or two, or sometimes even a week before I get back to you, but I promise I will get back to you.
Well, it's a beautiful book. It's on the Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica, your recent book just released, and of course Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians, that was published in December 2012. And these are valuable gems of understanding that we're connected to something much bigger than what we've been told. You know, so.
And thank you, Alan, for having me. I'm sorry our connection was so bad tonight.
We'll do it again sometime when a better connection. But
that'd
thank
be
you
great.
Thank you, Artie, Dr. Artie.
You're welcome.
Clark. I appreciate
okay.
that.
Bye.
Thanks. Okay, this is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And that was just a taste of some of the amazing stories, true stories. I truly believe these are true stories of people around the country, around the world, who've had some form of encounter. So I recommend those books. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. Good night.